Supatipanno Bhagavato Savakasangho Sangham Namami. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa. Iti pisso Bhagava Sambuddho Vijjacharana Sampanno Sugato Lokavidu Anuttaro Purissa Dhamma Sarati Sata Deva Manu Sanang Buddho Bhagava Tamahang Bhagavantak Abhipujayami. Tamahang Bhagavantak Sirasanamami. Bhagavata Dhammo Sanditiko Akaliko Ehipasiko Opanayiko Pachatang Veditabo Vinyuhi Tamahang Dhammang Abhipujayami. Tamahang Dhamma Sirasanamami.
Supatipanno
Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Ujjupatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Yaya Patipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Samichi Patipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Yati Dancha Tari Ata Purisa Pugala Esa Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Ahuneyo Pahuneyo Dakineyo Anjali Karaniyo Anuttarang Punya Ketang Lokasa Tamahang Sangang Abhipujayami Tamahang Sangang Sirasamamami.
Mm-hmm. So. Care. The questions. Dear Ajahn, what is the rationale for the Buddhist practice emphasis on taking care of one's parents, but not one's children, when becoming a monastic? It is especially one's parents when one becomes a monastic. It usually means your parents are getting old, and it seems to be that it's the children's job to look after the parents, and it's the grandchildren's job to look after your children. In other words, that once the children are mature enough, and the age of majority, whenever that age happens to be, they should be pretty much independent, one would hope. So, taking care of one's parents is an old tradition. One's teachers as well, one has to. But I was just contemplating, in the monastic system, that even your preceptor is supposed to be like a father to you. So all these monks, like that monk over there, the other monks, anyone around? No, they're all gone. So, good, I don't have to look after many people this evening. But they also have to look after me as well. And I look after them. There is like a mutual care between parents and children and children and parents. But especially when your parents get very old, and of course they're unable to look after themselves. Obviously your children are able to look after themselves when you are that age, you should be able to ordain. But one of the reasons why if a man or a woman still has young children to look after, now 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, even 10, 11, 12, usually I ask them not to ordain yet, to make sure you've got your children all looked after. And once your children are secure, they've been brought up, you've done your duties and responsibilities for your children, then maybe if you want to, you can ordain as a monastic. But my usual way of thinking is that if a person is not responsible enough to do their duties by their young children, they just want to go off into a monastery straight away and the children are still young, that's a little bit selfish. It's not regarding your duties to others. So because of that, you're looking after your children. You should do that as a layperson until your children get of an age so they can look after themselves. And then afterwards, that when your parents are old, then still, if you possibly can, you may be able to look after them as a monastic. I don't know if that really answers the question, but it's the best I can give. I've heard that the physical body is protected from harm when someone's in jhana. How can it be that someone doing walking meditation gets injuries and cuts if they are in jhana with metta? That's an interesting question. It may be the person wasn't really in the full jhanas, just getting close, maybe nimittas. But it is something which is weird, that when you are in the full jhanas, it seems to be that you are invulnerable. I think I mentioned that earlier, didn't I? Yeah. Not at all. Are you sure? First night? Okay, must be somewhere else. Okay, this was in the suttas, even there was a monk who was meditating in the forest. And when he was meditating in the forest, some villagers came by and saw him. I did say that, yeah. Okay.
So it's a different one.
Okay, a different one. Okay, the different one. There was this Indonesian monk, and he was meditating in the jungles. And he was the one that... His experience of jhanas, did I mention that one about marrying a star?
Yep.
Yeah. Okay, so you're amazing, because you let go of the past and live in the present moment. Wow, that's a really good meditation. But they do have these weird cases of people. I don't know why that is, but sort of in those deep meditations, it seems to be you're perfectly safe, and no one can do anything to you. I know also that I haven't seen this myself, but these in some festivals which they have, I think they're mostly like Hindu festivals, and where people skewer themselves with sharp rods, and they don't feel any pain. And it looks very, very painful to me. But there was also, I saw this in southern Thailand somewhere, that on one of these festivals, that they had like a big post, like a tree, and you could climb up it, but on swords, and the swords were supposed to be really sharp. And that the it was a festival in the evening, and many tourists came along as well, obviously, to see this weird, these people in trance, it seemed, would climb up these sword trees without having a cut or a scratch on their body. And apparently, in this part of Thailand, there was one tourist from Europe, and he thought this was just a scam. It was a trick. And he'd obviously had a few Singha beers or whatever. He was a bit sort of mad and crazy. So he decided to prove them all wrong. So he decided to try and climb up those sword trees. And I don't know how, 120 stitches or something he had. So it was reported in the newspapers that this was something really weird, that there really was not a trick, but some people going in some type of trance, and that these knives will not penetrate your skin. That's weird stuff, but I've seen much weird stuff in my life as a monk. And I remember I started off as a scientist, so it's not that I'm gullible. If you see some weird stuff, then it obviously must be true with your own eyes. Simple stuff. There was this, when I was a young monk in Thailand, one of the things which I did, I thought, well, it'd be nice to use whatever I knew about science to help the local village. So I actually built a methane generator, from the toilet waste in Wat Nanachat. And I suggested this because if you do it in the temple, the monastery, people will see it and they will maybe just follow it. It's a simple way of getting some clean energy. And the methane generator, as long as you just, it's a very simple device, and from the stuff from the toilets and maybe some buffalo dung, you put it in there and you get some methane coming out. And that's enough to actually to have a gas stove and do things like boiling water or cooking. And so I built one, but the main builder there, who was poor B, a villager, he went along with what I was doing and he thought I was really crazy. How can you get sort of energy out of, feces? And how can you sort of even boil a kettle out of this? But of course it worked, and when he saw this work, he said, wow, that's one of the most amazing things I've seen, even though it was science. And that's when he told me about the local snake charm doctor in Bung Wai village. And he said that, I never believed that you could cure snake bites with just a little charm, but I've seen it myself, and it's just like seeing you create gas out of feces. And that's when I said, well, is there a snake doctor there? He said, yeah, we threw all our snake venom away a long time ago. We just rely upon this doctor with his charm. And of course, in the village, especially when you are the rainy season, when all the snakes try and sort of hide away from getting drowned in the floodwaters, many people do get bitten by those snakes in Thailand. And so because of that, they have to take this thing really seriously. So anyway, that I never saw, and actually no one got bitten by a snake when I was there in Thailand in a monastery, but after I left, a couple of years later, I was told the story by one of the other monks. There was a Singapore monk And you know, one day he went to the library, and there's another monk in the library, and the other monk in the library just, this Singapore monk asked him, "Where's the snake book?" Like a little book with all the different types of snake which lived in that area. And so he said, "Oh, here it is," and handed it to him. And then the Singapore monk was looking through it and said, "Oh my goodness, it's venomous. That's the snake which just bit me." And the monk in the library, "What, you've been bit by a snake?" You can see it, there's the wound and the swelling on his leg. And so the librarian monk just ran into the village. It's one time where monks were allowed to run, you know, for obvious reasons. And he came back with the witch doctor. And this witch doctor looked at the wound, and it was, you know, really swelling, and you can see the puncture marks. And so he started doing his chant, and he chewing some sort of herb, spitting on the wound and chanting, and spitting on the wound and chanting. And this was a highly educated young monk from Singapore. And that was his leg, which had been bitten by a snake. And you can appreciate just his thoughts of the time. As he turned to some of the other monks who had congregated to see what was happening, and he pleaded, "Can I please have a proper doctor?" He didn't believe in all this hocus pocus. You know, he just wanted some anti-venom or something. It was his leg, he was dying. But then, just as the chanting continued, he could see the swelling go down. And the swelling went down, 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 and even the two puncture wounds just disappeared. The most amazing thing he'd ever seen. And he was very relieved that the snake bite had been dealt with. And it was one of those weird things which happen in life. How these things happen, why these things happen, but they did happen. And of course, the Singapore monk was lived to tell the tale, as all the other monks who saw it at the time. So there is weird stuff happens sometimes in this world. And as a scientist, as someone who's a rationalist, you can't just deny it. You have to say, "Well, here it's happened. Now, why did it happen?" Anyway, dear Ajahn, anyway, that if anyone gets bitten by a snake here, I've got my little charm. You know, I learned it from Ajahn Chah. You look at your wound and say, "You'll either get better or you'll die." And then you say, "Is that what a real doctor?" Could you please say a few things about what is and what is not meant by nirvana? It feels like a completely unobtainable enigma to me. I have read, for example, that a monk who becomes awakened must get to a monastery within 24 hours or will die. The whole concept is intangible and confusing to me. Please help. Have you ever read some quantum mechanics and quantum theory, which is also incomprehensible to so many people, but it's actually true? Just the ability to comprehend it doesn't, or not comprehend it, doesn't mean it's not true. But Nirvana is, did mention it, I think, earlier, but maybe not explicitly, that there was the Aggawachagota Sutta, and a simile was that where a flame, a candle flame, depends upon the wick, the wax, and the heat. And if any one of those three causes is taken away, the flame goes out. And the word in Pali for a flame going out is nirvanas. It's nibbuto, which is the past participle related to the noun nirvana. It just means extinguished, gone out, finished. And so, because even then, the word was well understood by even children in that time. "Now, Mummy, the flame's nibbanaed. Well, light it again." But the Buddha just asked Aggawachagota, he said, "When the flame goes out, where does it go to?" If it's been a very good flame, does it go to the heaven flames where all flames flicker for eternity, happy never to be going out again? If it's been a bad flame and burned somebody's finger, does it go down to some hell realm where it's, you know, it's even boiled by its own heat? What happens to a flame when it goes out? It doesn't go anywhere. It just goes out, finished, just extinguished. Is it just like the human being? Or any sort of being? Once in Nibbana, that's it, the end of the journey. And nothing more arises afterwards. That's a powerful statement. But for many people, they think, well, how can that be? And then what's the point? What's the point of getting enlightened, putting all that work in to become enlightened, and in the end, you're not there to enjoy it afterwards? And of course, the reason is when one fully understands what is going on there, the process, which we call a human being, the process of all beings, what they call the five components of existence, just going round and round and round. I don't know that there was some movie which I did watch, I confess this, on an aircraft because it was Bianca's partner when he was alive told me to watch this, and it was called Groundhog Day. And the reason why he told me to watch, he said, this is a nice simile of just, you know, reincarnation and rebirth. Apparently this person, I don't know why, but he went to bed at night and he woke up the morning before. So he kept on reliving the same day again and again and again and again. So an eternal existence. And he always remembered what happened yesterday. And you may think, oh, what a wonderful thing that is. You can keep on learning from your mistakes and perfect every day until it gets better and better and better every day. Because you can, you know, go back again and just don't make any mistakes anymore. So you can live a perfect day with no mistakes and wake up in the morning. But then what happened? The idea of eternal existence was just, after a while, when you've been there and done that, it becomes so much suffering. What more does he want to do? He gets bored by that. And so he tried to kill himself many times. You know, that's what we call in the Pali Vibhavadana, trying to stop his existence. And he did that by trying to, drive a car off a cliff, you know, go right in front of a railway engine, anything, blow himself up to try and kill himself. And of course his car would go over the cliff and in flames, and he'd wake up the morning of that day again. He just couldn't get rid of himself. And that was an interesting sort of premise, which is about samsara, about rebirth. Okay, you live this life, and then you die, you get reborn again. Here we go again. How many times do you want to wear nappies? Having to go, do you think you're finished with school? Do you think you're finished with relationships just because you're 60 or 70? Do you think you're finished with all the people misunderstanding you, you misunderstanding them? Now imagine you have to go through this again and again and again and again and again and again. When you actually look at that, like this gentleman who was the lead in Groundhog Day, he got intolerable to actually have to live the same old day. What are you doing it for? You've been rich, you've been poor, you know, you've had everything the world has to offer you. What more? You've been there and done it so many times. That would actually cause a huge amount of emotional pain. And so, the idea of actually being free from that, of it ceasing, was what was motivating his life. But where I didn't like that movie was the solution. Okay, this was Hollywood. And if I wrote the end of the script, he'd meet a Buddhist monk, he'd meditate, and he'd never get reborn again. That'd be the last day ever. But what did he do? He fell in love. And that boat disappeared. He woke up in the morning and it was a day after. So that was the end of the movie. But there was another movie which I also saw as a youth, which I was impressed with. And it was like a Dracula movie, a vampire. But it was one which was not just done for just blood and excitement. It was actually, they actually called it the thinking person's vampire, a Dracula movie. Because this Dracula, you know, the myth was that if Dracula got caught out in the sun, then he would die. Otherwise, he could live for eternity. And this Dracula character, he was torn. He couldn't live another day because he'd been there, done there. He was so bored with life. Everything he'd ever done was achieved. But then he was afraid of death. And so it was a conflict between eternal existence, which was painful, and ceasing his existence, which was scary. And in the end, he allowed himself just to be lured out into the sunlight because he couldn't stand eternal existence again. That was it. And there was a lot to be said about that. How many times do you want to be a ruler, a king, a queen, in power, a hermit, whatever? After a while, we've been there, we've done that. If you can remember all of this, do I have to do this again? So sometimes nirvana is like the end of the cycle. That's it, you're done. You graduated. You're free. So that's nirvana. But what's another way of looking at it? And the other way is just, it's like the cause of like ceasing to exist. It's not wanting anything anymore. Ceasing all of your desires, a freedom from desire. And that is something which I think people can get their heads around even more easily. It's not something like being extinguished. There's nothing there to begin with. It's just a process which has come to an end. The flame has gone out. And this particular, why it goes out, what is the cause of nirvana? And that's where we come to that simile of the five children playing the wishing game. And of course, you know, sometimes even I can't remember what I said, whether I've said that simile yet, because before this retreat, there was another retreat, and before that retreat, there was another retreat. I'm always talking some retreats, short retreats, long retreats. So after a while, I don't know what I've said about 8, 9 days ago, but I don't think I've said the simile of the five children playing the wishing game yet. Or have I? Okay, in this retreat. This was a great explanation of what nirvana is, what enlightenment is, and why. And it also brings out another couple of interesting points about life and one's aspirations. Five children playing the wishing game. The first kid, the wishing game rules where you're allowed a wish. Whoever comes up with the best wish would win the wishing game. So kid number one said, if I had a wish, I would wish for the latest computer game. And of course, I don't know what I'm talking about now. I was talking with some of the monks some time ago about computer games. These were the young monks. And they started talking. I hadn't got a clue what they were talking about. They might have been talking in ancient Greek as far as I could understand. And I just didn't know because it's way beyond the time when I was active. When I became a monk 45 years ago, I didn't have any computer games or anything, so I'm not quite sure what they were talking about. But anyway, they really knew everything about computer games. So anyway, a kid. So if I had a wish, I'd wish for a computer game. Great. Second kid, if I had a wish, I'd wish for a computer game shop. That's a better wish. The one who got the best wish would win the wishing game. Because with a shop, you can get a new computer game whenever a new one comes out. The third kid said, I can do better than that. Because he knew that when trouble with kids and computer games is your mother and father won't let you play them. They want you to go to school and study and get good grades. So this kid said, well, if I had a wish, I would wish for $1 billion US. Because with $1 billion US, first of all, I'll buy my own computer game shop, and then I'll buy my own school. And if I own the school, I won't need to attend the classes, because if anyone complains, I'll sack the teachers. And I'll make sure that I get the copy of the exam papers the day before, because I own the school and employ the security staff. And then I can always get the best grades every year without doing any work. And once I graduate from my own sort of grade school, primary school, I can buy my own high school. Once I graduate from there, I can actually buy my own university. And then, like Mr. Trump did, he owns Trump University. So once I own my own university, I can give myself honorary degrees, anything I need, because I own the joint. And in the meantime, I can play computer games all day. And my mummy can't complain. And also that anything else I want with $1 billion US, I can't sort of spend all that in one lifetime. So I've got the $1 billion US wish, beat that. And the next kid, this girl, she was really smart. I can beat that. Just saying $2 billion or $3 billion, that's just basically the same. It's all the money you can spend in one lifetime. So she said, if I had a wish, I would wish for 3 wishes. That's a wish. Well, the first wish, I'll have the computer game shop. The second wish, $1 billion US. For my third wish, I'll have 3 more wishes. I can go on forever. Beat that. And this was the infinity of wishes granted. That's a pretty hard wish to beat. But the last kid easily beat that. The last kid said, if I had a wish I was so content and happy I never needed any more wishes ever again. So content, easily satisfied, not proud, not demanding in nature, I don't need wishes. That's enlightenment. That's an arahat, a Buddha. The end of desire. The end of ill will. So content, you don't need any wishes. The one before that, the infinity of wishes, that's what we call like dictators. People who like power. I often wondered, why is it these multimillionaires want to join politics? Because just being a billionaire is not enough. You need power. And so that's why you do get... why does a person want to join politics? It's so hard, really, you know, lots of work. You always get sort of a lot of people just don't like you. And you join politics and you're a billionaire before. Why don't you just retire and enjoy yourself? Because just being wealthy... It's not as pleasure-giving, not as freeing, as being in a power where all your desires can be met. Not just with money, but because all your desires, you have infinity of desires which can be approved, can be met. So the infinity of desire wish is more powerful than being the billionaire. But of course, even better than having an infinity of wishes, having power. So all your desires come true. Even more than that is just being free from desires. The difference between the freedom of desires and the freedom from desires. And nirvana is the freedom from desires. You're happy, you don't need anything. Ajahn, you mentioned last night that at death one would experience joy as the 6 sense bases are abandoned. 5 sense bases are abandoned at death. Six sense base, the mind is still there. Does that mean everyone at death experience has jhana? No. If this is so, can we still able to have insights at that point, or is it game over? Not game over. Unfortunately, the game continues on. It's just that death is just a tea break. Before you carry on afterwards, another birth, another life. So anyway, so what happens that the 5 senses disappear? The mind is still there, and that means that sometimes one sees a beautiful light, so everyone has the opportunity to even like merge into that light if you wish to. But anyway, at that time, because you're letting go a huge amount, of course you have insight. You never own these 5 senses anyway. You never own this body. And sometimes you wonder why you keep worrying so much about this body. Dear Ajahn, I believe that I have been conditioned into a very cynical, self-disparaging mind that blocks out much of the magic of life. How does one go beyond the mindset to find more beauty and meaning in life, and most of all to make what now seems impossible and incomprehensible nirvana something real? It's easy. Most people are conditioned into a cynical, self-disparaging mind, but instead of self-disparaging, self-disappearing mind. That is much more easy. So, and after a while, that you get reconditioned. I don't know, somehow or other you managed to come here. I mean, why you came here, who knows, but you are here. And here, you don't get disparaged. You get disappeared. The self-disappearing mind, where your ideas of who you were are going, going, gone. And how to go beyond this mindset is you just, number one, hang around sort of people who have meditated, people who are peaceful. People have, why are the nuns here just, you know, so inspiring? Why do people keep coming to see me? I've got nothing. And magic of life? Sometimes you look at monks like me and say, wow, look at that guy. He's happy, but he's got nothing. He's got no safety nets. I've got no pension scheme. I've got no insurance scheme. I've got no, what else haven't I got? Well, look, let's tell you a story about this. That was when I decided, just because I could, to get a Commonwealth Seniors Health Card. You're allowed to get that, I think, if you're 60. But now I was 60, I said, well, why not get one? So I don't get any benefits from it. But nevertheless, I applied for it. So I thought, you just go online and tick a few boxes and you get this senior's health card. But then what happened was that they said, no, you know, you can't just do it online. You have to come up to the office because of the problem of identity fraud. Somehow I've got to go with all my ID to prove I was who I was. And so I went in there to the Armadale office of Centrelink, had to make an appointment, and bring all my ID, whatever I had, and the lady who interviewed me, sitting in front, the other side of a desk, said, now, we need you to prove you are who you are. Can you prove who you are? And at which point I stopped and said, madam, I've been a monk for 45 years. I've been trying to answer that question myself over the last 45 years, so I don't think I can. And she didn't think that was funny. She said, I wanted ID. And said, have you got your driving license? I said, no, monk, I don't drive. So I haven't got an driving license. I did have a passport. Okay, great, got a passport. You haven't got a driving license. What about your credit card? No. Your bank account? No. Your rental agreement? No. Your ownership of a house? Details? No. Your marriage certificate? I actually asked for that. Don't have one of those either. And I went through all this list of things which prove you are who you are. And I had none of it except the passport. She said, you just don't exist. I said, sadhu, 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 the Buddha was right after all. Because if you go through all the list of things you've got to tick to, you know, to get identity, monks, we don't have those. So we cause a lot of problem. I managed to get that senior's health card because I also have a British passport. So I'm not really supposed to have two passports, but if you got it, okay, fair enough. She just wanted to get rid of me, the troublemaker. But it's interesting just to know, who are you? And sometimes self-disparaging, even identity fraud, Apparently I do have a Facebook account, but I don't run it. I don't know what goes on in there. Somebody else runs a Facebook. Apparently I've got a couple of Facebook accounts, apparently. So somebody's got some identity fraud going on there, but they can keep me. I don't need to be me. In fact, you know, I just wonder, you know, who am I anyway? So how can you have, if anybody just wanted identity fraud, they can have it. In other words, it's wonderful, then I'm not Ajahn Brahm anymore. Yay! Anyway, anyway, they never get identity fraud from me because what is there to steal? Who wants to be Ajahn Brahm? Would you like to be Ajahn Brahm? It's hard work. So identity fraud is, and also just, sometimes I was joking with Ajahn Bamali the other day, that, you know, sometimes in Christianity, the worst sin is if somebody steals your soul. And usually the devil comes and you trade your soul to the devil. So we're talking with Ajahn Bamali, he said, if the devil came to me and said, do you want to sell your soul to the devil? I say, yeah, how much? I give the donation to the nuns' monastery. And of course, when they come to collect my soul, I say, it's not there. You've got a bad end of the bargain, devil, because I don't exist. There's no soul there. So anyway, we have lots of fun with non-self. But anyway, incomprehensible nirvana, after a while you get your head around what this nirvana is. It's not something, not a heaven realm, it's something much more refined than that. All about when this idea of a self for me disappears. Wherever there is a self, there's always something you have to live up to and do. This is that little saying which you saw, they could leave it down there. The little saying which I saw on the philosophy department of Cambridge University. And it started off with a quote from René Descartes. He says, to do is to be. And underneath that was a quote by the French existential philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre, who turned around and said, no, to be is to do. And then underneath there was a quote from the contemporary American philosopher, dooby-dooby-doo, Frank Sinatra. I remember seeing that on the walls at the time. But even though that's a sort of a funny anecdote, it showed the connection between doing and being, between the will and consciousness, the consciousness and will. Because if you don't do anything, the sense of will and consciousness vanishes. Who are you? And a lot of times we define ourselves by what we do. I'm an engineer. You're not an engineer, that's just what you do. I'm a nun. That's not who you are, that's just what you do. I'm lazy. You're not lazy. That's just what you do. So our identity, if we did nothing, really did nothing, you would disappear. You'd have no ID, which meant no identity view. One of those fetters which stop you being a stream winner is destroyed. Who are you? No one in particular. And you can change who you are. Just like I told you that story of that Sri Lankan who I thought was the ice cream van. When she looked at me and first saw me, she saw a dirty monk, a builder, and then later on she saw this well-dressed monk who was Ajahn Brahm. Which is the real Ajahn Brahm? And of course, neither of them are. So, this is where we learn that doing is what creates your identity. And when you stop doing stuff, it becomes a challenge to you when people retire. And they're no longer a politician. it challenges them. They're no longer an accountant. It can challenge you. Because your whole identity is taken up, defined by what you do. If you stop doing things, you start to vanish. And do you see some of the reasons why this type of meditation can be scary? You sit here meditating, you're not doing anything. If you follow my instructions, you're letting things be. It gets really peaceful. A lot of joy comes up. But the scary bit is that you are disappearing. You're vanishing. Who you thought you were is going. And little by little, old, young, female, male, monk, nun, all of that is going. And when you don't do anything, you find most of your reference points to who you are disappear. Truth requires a lot of courage to go past your comfort zones, the places you're used to, and go to places which are blissful and free, but extremely different. So, even in the jhanas, you are not a monk or a nun anymore. All that stuff has been left behind. That's your past. All those definitions. That's why I said that sometimes even those Christian monks or nuns thought it was union with God, being something that was really powerful. But of course, we go way beyond that in these meditations, and we disappear. And we're happy to disappear, to let go, because everything we ever thought we were, we stop doing things, become incredibly still. And that's when identity vanishes. So, this is a package. It's beautiful to be still, be peaceful. But then, the price of that is you have to vanish. And I'm very happy to vanish, as the Buddha did. Anyway, that gives you something about why, if you do stuff, you just make a stronger sense of self. Have you ever noticed that people who've just really got strong wills, who've got strong personalities, big egos, have big wills, people who let go of their will, they just disappear. Ego, she-go, we all have to go. How does one talk to devas through deep meditation? Well, that's an interesting question. How do you talk to devas through deep meditation? Is that sometimes that when your mind is powerful, now number one, it can actually hold a thought and direct, not a thought, not like a word thought, but hold an idea and project that idea. So devas, my deva story. There's lots of deva stories. Which one should I use? Okay. The silly one, first of all. That there was this monk, a Burmese monk. This was in the time of the Second World... No, sorry, he was a Thai monk living in Burma during the time of the Second World War. And at that time, once Thailand was taken over by the Japanese troops, that all Thais were actually the enemies of the British. And especially Thai monks were considered to be spies. So many Thai monks living in Burma at the time were arrested and interrogated and treated very badly. So when this Thai monk, who was a really good forest monk, was actually in Burma, and the British took over, they encouraged him, please, it's time to go, to leave, it's dangerous for you here. But he couldn't go on the main roads because that was, you know, patrolled, and the checkpoints were run by the British troops. So they sent him over the mountains, the jungle paths. You know, where there's hardly any villages there at all, the wilderness areas. He was a fit monk, but, and I remember living in that area, and those paths were just, you know, really 60-degree slopes. It was just really hard work just to walk for a few miles. And he faced many days of this, going from Burma into Thailand. And there was no villages around. So not only was he getting tired, but he was also getting exhausted because he hadn't eaten for a while. And so, you know, he really started to think that he's not going to make this journey. He's going to die on the way. And as he was walking, getting weaker and weaker, hadn't eaten for days, hadn't seen a village for days, he started thinking, in the time of the Buddha, that sometimes there were heavenly beings, these devas, who would feed good monks. And so he thought to himself, well, I'm a good monk. So, and you know, if we are heavenly beings, they should feed me. And that was his thought in his biography when he turned a corner in the path, and in the middle of the wilderness, in the jungle, there was a man standing with the tiffin cans, you know, these trays, you know, like one after another on the top, held by sort of some handle, which is what people used to use to carry food from place to place. And a monk is not supposed to ask. Wait till actually you're invited in our tradition. And the words of invitation will be, Nimon Krap. And so he was walking there, and this fellow there, you know, he noticed he was very well dressed. You know, like very good Bangkok clothes. Not like a villager who dresses in rags, because, you know, there's no shops over in the jungles. And so the man just said, Nimon Krap. And the monk opened his bowl, and this man put in hot, delicious, refined food. And usually the monk, if anything, just gives a blessing. But the monk is not really, shouldn't ask anything alike. But this monk couldn't help himself. He said, where do you come from? Hadn't seen a village for days, and this was a well-dressed man. And how on earth did he know there was a monk coming and had food prepared? And apparently this man never said anything, just pointed upwards, which the monk took to be this was a heavenly being. It was weird, it was strange, because you don't have well-dressed people with food who know a monk is coming. Another monk would have come for a couple of years. So he thought that, he told everybody this was a heavenly being, helped him get through that journey. Now, fast forward another, maybe 60 years or so, or no, maybe not that long, maybe about 30 or 40 years. And there was this young Western monk who was walking through the mountains or the hills of Phupan district in the northeast of Thailand. And even though that, you know, he had ate that day, you know, he was out of water. He'd been out of water for a long time, and it was a very, very hot, cloudless day. And he was really wondering whether he would get some, what's it called, heat stroke, and also dehydration. Usually the monks would actually carry some water and ask from a village, but there hadn't been any village seen for miles. And when he got to the top of the hill, he saw that in the valley there was a village, about 5 or 6 houses. And he knew from experience in one of those houses would be the general store. And in the general store, which would sell cigarettes and kerosene and matches and just general supplies, but it also would sell bottles of Pepsi. Pepsi Cola, I can't remember if it was Pepsi Cola or Coca Cola, one of the two. I think it was Pepsi Cola. And, have I given it away? I can't remember which was. Of course, that Western monk was me. And I was really sort of thirsty. Actually, later on in that journey, I did get some heat stroke, you know, and just sat under a tree for a couple of hours to get my energies back again, used meditation to get through it, and I started getting very, very dizzy. But anyway, there I thought to myself, I'm a good monk. And I was a good monk, really committed to my meditation. I wasn't just becoming a monk for an easy life. I've been walking all day, just this was on those years when you take everything you own with you. And I thought, this is a good test. If there are heavenly beings, if there really are heavenly beings, I made a resolution. Will one of them give me a Pepsi Cola? Because I need one, or some water, something to drink. And it wasn't as if you had any choice. It was either that or nothing. So I made the resolution, and being a good monk, walked into the village and never said anything. Just my gaze, like in walking meditation, about a body length in front of me, not looking to the left, not looking to the right. And as I walked through the village, in my corner of my eye, I did see the general store, where it was. I walked past, no one stopped me. Okay, there are no devas, or maybe I'm not a good enough monk to actually to get any help. But then, I heard someone running up behind me, Nimon Krap! And as I turned round, they were holding an open bottle of Pepsi Cola, offering it to me. Now, I was lived in Thailand for 9 years, and that was strange. It was not common that people would just stop and offer a monk a Pepsi Cola. But what happened next was another person came running out, Nimon Krap, and gave another Pepsi Cola, and then another, and then another, and then another, 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 another. And I sat down on a bench and put the 9 bottles of Pepsi Cola in front of me. And anyone who's been to Thailand knows that 9 is the magic number. That's over in China, 8 is a magic number. In Korea, 7. But in Thailand, it's always 9. And I saw 9 bottles of Pepsi Cola. Nothing has ever come close to that. And I realized, okay, sadhu, sadhu, thank you, Davis, that such devas do exist and helping me get through my journey. So that's my 9 bottles of Pepsi Cola story. Certainly convinced me. But of course you can't use those requests too often. So how can you talk to devas? You make a request. Okay, I don't think I'm going to finish these questions. Talking to devas, personal story number 2, some of you were here when this happened, is, how long ago was this now? Maybe about 15 years ago, maybe? Our Buddhist Society of Western Australia was having their 30th anniversary, 30 years since they were founded. And I was the head monk at the time, and the president of the Buddhist Society at the time was Sol Hanna, who still helps out doing the IT work. And he figured out, he said, oh, it's going to be our 30th anniversary, we should do something special. So he wanted to do a ceremony in, I think, South Perth somewhere. And I said, no, if we're going to do a ceremony, let's do a big one. Because in the center of Perth, the Supreme Court Gardens, that's where they would hold huge rallies and ceremonies and circuses and stuff. Let's see if Supreme Court Gardens is available. And it was. And the 30th anniversary was on Waisak. The Waisak was on the full moon night on a Sunday. So this is perfect. Sunday, everyone could come, be the full moon day. And I managed to talk the Premier of Western Australia at the time, Jeff Gallop, that's when I started really getting friendly with him, to come for the ceremony. And I told everybody, forget about the finances, let's really go for it. This is Buddhism just showing it's arrived in Western Australia. And so we had this huge ceremony, all organized and booked, and we put so much effort and finances into doing this. Supreme Court Gardens, a full moon night, 30th anniversary, all these VIPs were going to come, and rain. In the morning, it was pouring down. You look to the forecast. A severe weather event was coming to Western Australia. A storm, cyclone, I don't know what you call it. And it was due to hit Perth, the centre of Perth, at 7 p.m. that evening. And our ceremony was supposed to start at 7 p.m. that evening. And it was pouring down. How many of you were there at the time? Anyone? A couple, okay. You can actually say that this is actually happened. It was pouring down at the time. And it was getting worse and worse and worse. And it was three times the premier's office, the secretary rang. Are you going to cancel? I said, no, we're not cancelling. And and even the Brian Creek, you remember, he passed away some years ago. He said, look, I was in the Merchant Navy. I sailed these oceans. And there's a, I've seen the pressure of the barometer. It's going down, down, down. A storm is coming. You can't go ahead with this. You've got to stop. I said, no. And even, you remember, just someone's ex-husband was a monk at the time. And he took me aside. I remember he grabbed me by the shoulder, good old Chris. And he said, Ajahn Brahm, you're embarrassing us. You know, you've got to be reasonable, you know, scientific. It's a storm coming. We can't do this ceremony in the middle of a big storm. No, we're doing it. And of course, you know, about how do you talk to devas through meditation? I really laid it on the line to those devas. I did some really heavy chanting. And anyway, so what happened next was, it's still pouring down with rain. And I must say, just sadness, the inspiration to all the people who helped on that day, getting soaked to the skin and still having confidence this was going to work. And so it got the about 7:15, maybe 22. I remember this, the Burmese lady, Shirley. Those of you who know the people in town, that's Cherry's deceased mother. I was in the VIP tent just trying to organize stuff, and she came running in, crying. And I thought, what else could go wrong? You know, when you're sort of organizing a ceremony and it's raining and there's all sorts of problems, and then someone comes in there crying, who's slipped over, who's electrocuted themselves, I don't know, well, okay. And she just dragged me outside. But she wasn't something gone wrong, she just pointed up at the sky. The rain had stopped and the full moon, the clouds had parted. You could see the full Waisak moon there. She never expected to see that, neither did I. And that's what burst into tears she did. I never cried yet. I'll tell you, I cried the next day. But I didn't have time to cry, to let my emotions, because there's still too much to do. And the rain stopped. And went to meet the premier who came, and the VIPs, the Thai ambassador Suchitra, she came. And there was a TV crew there. And the TV crew, they're following me around. And I always remember the presenter there saying, this is weird. This is weird. This is weird. And my goodness, it was weird. We did the ceremony. There was a slight shower for about 2 minutes, but didn't really affect anybody. We finished the ceremony. Once the ceremony was over, it poured down with rain. And that Supreme Court Gardens was flooded. The freeway was flooded in the morning. And it's very rare that freeways close and flood because of the rains. And many people, you know, we got a fair turnout, but not, some people never turned up. And they said, why didn't you come? What, you actually did the ceremony? Yeah. Because to the east, to the west, to the north, to the south, trees were coming down. Rain was lashing. They couldn't believe that we did the ceremony. And even the people who hired out the tents and the chairs and electricity and the stage. It was kind of Reese Hire, remember the name was. And the CEO sent a letter, an email, which was referred to me. And it said, I don't know who this Ajahn Brahm is, but can you please ask him who's going to win the horse racing today? Well, that was how much faith they had in something weird had happened. The heavenly beings had actually stopped, not just rain, this was a storm. And just for 2 hours so we can do the ceremony. And then it was only afterwards, because you know, when you're doing all this stuff, you're just it's working so hard. Go to bed really late, and the following morning I was going off to Melbourne, you know, to do, help with their Waisak. So, you know, I was just really tired, only slept for a few hours. Got to the domestic terminal in Perth, checked in and had about sort of 45 minutes before the aircraft took off, or an hour. So I just went into a corner. I thought it was going to be quiet, and just wept. Inspiration. Something amazing had happened. And now is the opportunity to allow that piti sukha to come up. Just the tears came down. That was just how inspiring it was, that you just stood back and just, these devas, whoa. When they want to help and it's something really worthwhile, they can really do amazing stuff. So anyway, if you don't believe all that stuff, ask some of the people here who saw it. That was weird stuff. Anyway, so even Ajahn Brahmadi was here. And he's someone, he doesn't sort of believe in miracles or weird stuff. But he said, okay, I've got to hand that to you. That was weird. Shouldn't have happened, but it did. Anyway, what has been one of the most difficult times of your monastic career? You don't think of them, they're not difficult times in my monastic career. They're all interesting times. I suppose, you know, when Ajahn Jagro disrobed, because that was not in my plans, and I had to become the abbot. But remember, like being an abbot, being a head teacher, I always thought that, well, it doesn't matter, nothing to lose. If I do well and can give good talks and can inspire people, wonderful. And I can actually get Buddhism to be strong. But if I'm no good and I haven't got those qualities in me, that's even better, that I can become a hermit. So it's, you know, both ways for me, it's win-win. Most difficult times? I don't know. Basically no difficult times. Every time there's any difficulty, just like I tell you, I practice what I preach. Any difficulty, it's just more, I'm too tired to say the right words, more dog shit for my mango growth. So it means that I can just get some more things going. Ajahn, I love the Jhana Grove experience and want to imbibe all of its culture. What is the reason for the specific way of paying respect three times to the ground and three times with hands together? Is it okay to pay respects in my own way? Sure. One of the reasons we bow three times is because it exercises our tummy muscles so that we don't get fat. Have you ever noticed just how, you know, some of these women are very devout, they bow, 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 and that's just much better than doing other sort of exercises. And of course, because people bow to me and I don't bow enough, that's why, of course, this gets a bit fat. But why bow three times? Okay, I'm not going to finish these this evening, so I'm going to finish at 9:30, no matter what questions are answered, what aren't. So the story behind that is, you know, because I've got lots of friends. I've met this fellow, you know, from the work with cancer sufferers, and he was the Anglican chaplain of Christchurch Grammar School, which is one of the top Christian schools in Perth. And so, you know, he'd heard many of the talks. He said, you know, I want to get you to come to our assembly to give a talk to the kids. So I agreed, Father Frank Sheehan. And so I arrived there early, and we had to wait outside the assembly, the hall, as the children were, you know, were settled, because we had to go in procession. It was a top sort of school disciplined. And the outside was the chaplain, Frank Sheehan, and there was the principal, I don't forget what his name was, and it was me. And the principal looked at me and said, Ajahn Brahm, thank you for coming to our school. We're just going to, once the kids are settled, we're going to go in procession in there. And it's a Christian school, so there's a little statue of Jesus there, and we're going to bow our heads to them out of respect. You're a Buddhist, you don't have to bow. And I took my opportunity at that point. I looked to the principal in the eye and said, I demand my right to bow to your statue of Jesus. You know, in typical cheeky Ajahn Brahm fashion, and he didn't know what I was up to. This is the training I got from Ajahn Chah, always doing the unexpected. And so I said, there's always something which I can see in your statue which I respect, and that's what I'm going to bow to. And so the three of us went in there, and I bowed my head to the statue of Jesus. I'm not a Christian, but there's many things in there which I can respect, and that's what I bow to. And And I explained to him afterwards, when I bow to a Buddha statue three times, I bow to three things. And three things which really mean something to me. I bow to the first thing is to virtue. Virtue, goodness, kindness, honesty, you know, being sincere, not being hypocritical, being forgiving, all those things which are trustworthy, all those things which we count as virtue in life. Because to me, just living in a monastic community, living in a Buddhist community, oh yeah, it's just like an oasis of trust and kindness, where we don't go hurting one another, and where I can trust my fellow monks and nuns. So that means that, you know, my life is just happy living in a virtuous community. And I try and encourage that virtue in whichever way you can in our world. So I respect virtue so much. You know, precepts, goodness, not as, you know, trying to be a goody-goody and just, I'm more virtuous than you are. How many precepts do you keep? You're only on 5? Oh, I'm on 8. 8? Nah, I'm on 10. 10? No, I'm on 227. 237? How many are you on? Sorry? 311. And so sometimes people say, why is it that the nuns have more precepts than the monks? Is that oppressing the nuns? I said, no. The higher the precepts, the higher you are. 8 precepts is higher than 5, isn't it? 10 is higher than 8. 227 is better than 10. So 311, wow, you're way up there. Way beyond the monks. But anyhow, so I said, I love virtue. And I respect it so much. So every time I bow my head, I'm respecting virtue. I put it up here somewhere. And the next thing which I bow to is peace. Peace, you know, in our communities, in our monasteries, peace in our Buddhist society, peace, you know, in Jhana Grove, the silent peace which we have here. This peace is what people remember this place by. And it's also peace in my own mind, the calm, silent. So I can just sit here and chill out, and my mind isn't bothering me. Just like you can chill out here, and the Jhana Grove doesn't bother you. It's calm, it's accepting, it's warm. It embraces you, Jhana Grove, in its kind arms of peace. And so I respect peace so much, I bow to it. And the third thing which I bow to is a combination of wisdom and compassion. Because every time you see it, like wisdom just solves problems so beautifully, and with kindness as well. When you see wonderful acts of kindness, then that really sort of moves me. The times when I've seen somebody go that extra step to look after you, to make sure you're okay and happy and well. They find that if somebody does have a sickness, someone will stop what they're doing and take you to a doctor or get you some medicines or something, or they'll come and bring food to your room to make sure you're okay. Little acts of kindness just move me. That's why I bow to it. I worship compassion. I worship peace. I worship virtue. And that's what the Buddha statue means to me. In Pali, Sila Samadhi Panya. And when I see that and I bow to it, I remember its importance so many times every day. That's why I bow. And it makes it meaningful for me. So having explained that to the Christian principal of Christ Church Grammar School, a couple of weeks later, he arranged the bus trips for some of the senior students to come to Bodhinyana. And so I walked with him into the hall, which many of you have sat in, and together we both bowed to the Buddha statue, as I bowed to the statue of Christ in his school. It was a wonderful way that we had some harmony there, and understanding why we're bowing. We're bowing to that inside this, this statue which reminds us of something which is inspiring, which sometimes we forget. That's why we bow. We don't just bow not knowing what we're doing just because everyone else is doing it. It's just like, oh. When I was in Thailand, when people would bow to a statue, sometimes they'd offer flowers, candles and incense. They just, you know, put it between the hands and they put it in the incense container. When I went to Singapore and Malaysia, they never did it that way. They took the incense and they shook it. And then they put it in. Have you seen that? Why? I'll tell you. I know the answer to that one because you worked it out. Because you know that, you know, in Singapore or Malaysia or Hong Kong or in Taiwan, usually it's your grandma takes you to the temple because your parents are just taking... Yeah, because you got it. Because your grandparents introduce you and show you what to do and how to do it, your grandma, many of them do have Parkinson's. And because they're shaking as they hold it in, and the little kids think, oh, that's how I'm supposed to do it. And they haven't got Parkinson's, they're only 4 or 5, and they still do this, and they put it in there. And that's where you've been brainwashed. So that's why you do that. It's fascinating using your scientific methods of deduction to find out why that happens. Okay. That's how we pay respects. How is the will, okay, fully conditioned, but we can choose to put right effort into meditation? And that's why if you choose to put right effort into meditation, you'll stuff it up. It's not right effort, it's right restraint, it's right stopping, it's saying no to things. Whatever arouses really good qualities, and just to maintain it. So you get, how do you get anonymity to come up? Or how can you maintain your awareness of the breath? Okay, you can put effort in, but it's, you can't keep your breath for long periods of time based on effort. You get tired or worn out. And instead, you have this beautiful relaxing, letting go. Because you let it go, you can do it for hours. You know that story which I said first of all, and you confirmed to me, how can I keep the water still? By putting it down. It's still by itself. And you can do that for hours because it's no effort to leave it alone, not to grasp it, not to hold it, not to want anything. So it's right letting go, it's right renunciation, it's right restraint, samavayama, before the stillness happens on samadhi. So you can choose. This was the work I mentioned to someone earlier, a Professor John Libet, L-I-B-E-T, who did some work on the nature of the will. Because, you know, he was one of the first people who could, you know, use these machines who can actually see what happens when you make a choice to your brain. And what he discovered, you can look at this research, that this machine, our experimenters were just choosing to, something simple, flex their wrist or open their wrist. And they could choose whenever they wanted to. And they had another finger that when they decided to choose, to make the choice to flex the wrist, they'd press the button. And he was making all sorts of allowances for reaction time and stuff. What he found consistently was that the brain lit up first, so something in the brain decided to flex the wrist, flex the wrist. Then that which you take to be will happened afterwards, and then you flex the wrist. That which you recognize as your will, which you can be aware of and mindful of, that does not initiate the action. By the time that you think you're doing the will, the action's already happening. And then it happens. Because we can't see what's lighting up in our brain, what happens before we will, we always connect will, action. So we think we choose to do things. But something has happened before, which obviously electric gizmos on your brain can actually see. And that's scary. What actually lights up the brain, which makes that action about to happen? Then you have the will. Then you have the action. Scary stuff, but hard science. Whenever I put my attention on the breath, I start to control the breath. Any tips? It's interesting. Whenever you put your attention on anything, on how your son is driving the car, you tend to control. That's not the way to drive the car, son. Turn left, turn right. Don't do it this way. It's called backseat driving. I'll prove now another example. Now be aware of the saliva in your throat. Do you notice the saliva? Now just drop it and just listen to what I'm saying next. You can't drop it. Because once you're aware of it, it's uncomfortable. It's a problem now. Before, it was no problem at all. What's going on? Why is it when you watch the breath, it's a bit uncomfortable, you control it. But when you don't watch it, it goes beautifully. Whatever we watch, we interfere with. That's one of the reasons why our mindfulness has to be very strong. So we can watch something without interfering. It's a tough one. But after a while, people tell me, what should I do when I have too much saliva in my throat when I'm meditating? Should I swallow? Disturbs my meditation. Should I just drool? And there is an alternative. If you have a problem with too much saliva when you're meditating, you would borrow one of these machines from the dentist. You know, this crooked thing. So you have no problem with your meditation. It's simple. How many disciples do you have? 100,000? I don't know. Actually, I have no disciples. I don't have them. I don't own them. I don't carry them around. You let go of everything. If you experience jhanas, will you no longer wish to care for your family or become detached from them? Will you become weird? You mean I'm weird? No, of course you care for your family, but you care for them in a much better way than before. And become detached from them? Yes, you could become detached from them. But being detached doesn't mean you don't care. In fact, you can care with a much purer heart. You love, expecting nothing back in return, because you are detached. You don't own them. You serve them. How does one know when to accept praise as encouragement and when to let it go through seeing its harm? Is it possible to do these without upsetting the one who's doing the praising? Why is praise harmful? Exactly. It's only because you always think that praise is harmful. And you say it will go to your head. People praise me a lot. It doesn't go to my head. I haven't got a big head. It goes to your tummy. You get a big stomach, not a big head. And in fact, people don't praise each other enough. You know, sometimes my research is just, you know, done in all sorts of weird experiences. I remember, again, because my mind is on giving a talk at a school. I went to give a talk at a school somewhere, I don't know where, and I got the bus back. I had one of these bus passes back to, I think, the temple in Nottamara. It's great to be able to go on public transport whenever a monk can. So sometimes, if there is a public transport, don't say, oh, no, I don't bother, I'll give you a lift to make merit for yourself. No, please let me go on the public transport. It's a really good experience, because I was sitting behind two schoolgirls, maybe 13 or 14, you know, after they'd finished their school day, and just listening to them, how they talked. You know, just, and I couldn't believe it. These are obviously good friends. And one of them said to the other, you know, you've got flat breasts, you'll never get a boyfriend. Yeah, look at you, you've got a big nose, you won't get anybody. And these were friends talking to you. And it went on like that for over half an hour. And even your friends are putting you down. Imagine what your enemies do. And so I really felt sorry for these two schoolgirls. Even their friends disparaging them and taking away their lack of self-esteem and just making them feel that they're hopeless. And unless they become top of the class in something or other, they're hopeless at studies. And the parents and the mother keeps on telling you, you're not working hard enough, you're spending too much time on a computer or something. We always get so much criticism. And so I really feel for kids growing up, all they ever hear is, you know, you're not funny enough, you're not working hard enough, you're not clever enough, you're not something enough. You don't know what to say, what you're supposed to do to survive as a young boy or young girl growing up. All you ever get is put downs, even from your friends. And you can understand what it does to you after a while. So I always encourage the parents, please praise your kids. And even if you, you have to bite your lip. I know your room is a mess, but you know, it's, I've seen other rooms that are much more messy than that. Because that's what kids need. At least they can come home and be praised, be uplifted. Just anything which they do. And you get much more out of your kids if you praise them. Even just, it's really hard to see the nice parts in them. Say, well done. You're doing wonderful. But that story of, because I saw that so often, when I became a school teacher, I wasn't going to become a school teacher who just criticized the kids I taught if they made a mistake or did something wrong. To the point that when at the end of the school year, and it was, I had to give out the report cards, for the end of the school year, where the kids were graded. And there was one child in my class of 30 who came bottom of the class, 30th out of a class of 30. And he never expected that. It was a surprise for him. He knew he didn't do well, but never expected bottom. And when I gave out the report card to him, bottom of the class, his shoulders dropped, his head went down. And he was realizing that's what he would face from his friends, first of all. Dummy, stupid, and bottom of the class. Even from his friends at school, they would call him a dummy. And then what he would get when he went home to see his parents. How did you do, bottom of the class? And he would get a scolding from his father. His mother would tell him he can't do this, he's got to study more, he can do much better than this, he's ashamed of the family, blah, blah, blah. And you could see him starting to imagine what would happen to him that evening. And so I went right up to him because I can't allow someone to suffer like that, not in my class when I've got a responsibility for them. They knew I was a Buddhist. I said I taught them meditation when in 1973 or something, four or whatever, 73, a whole load of them. I went up to him and I said, you've come bottom of the class. Yes, sir. And then I said, I'm going to teach you a part of Buddhism called the Bodhisattva. A Bodhisattva who's someone who doesn't think about their own self and their happiness, who's got no pride at all, who sacrifices themselves so that no one else will suffer. And I said, that, in my opinion, is you. I know you can do much better than bottom of the class, but this year you decided, intentionally, on purpose, to take the bottom position in this class, so no one else will have to suffer what you're going to get from your parents this evening. Now, you sacrificed yourself so none of your friends will have to experience this. Oh, your friends, they just think about themselves, their own pride, wanting to do well at school, but you decided, to be bottom. And that's a typical bodhisattva, to sacrifice yourself so no one else will have to suffer that. And he said, I'm proud of you. You're the most, I've been teaching some little Buddhism to you guys, you're the only ones who really understand it. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. I'm going to go, as soon as this class is over, to the principal, and I'm going to recommend you, just you, for the Bodhisattva of the Year prize in this school. What a wonderful prize that would be. For people who don't not measured by achievements, but measured by how much you've let go and sacrificed so others don't have to suffer. You really cared about other people. That's why you came bottom. Sadhu, well done. And I remember looking up at me. It's the most craziest teacher he's ever had in his whole career. But his depression broke. His fear, and he started laughing. And I did say before I left, you know, his side, I said, now, one extra thing I have to tell you. In this school, you're only allowed to get the Bodhisattva prize once in your school career. So next time, let some of your other friends take part of the position. Okay, deal? Yeah, deal. So that's how I dealt with people who were suffering, you know, and this coming top, coming bottom. What's that all about? Anyway, that's why we take care of kids in school. And so I was praising them. And how can you praise someone who's come bottom, has really messed up their exams? The Bodhisattvas, yay, well done. So these are little ways where, by giving praise to everybody, they actually don't get big heads. It takes away a lot of the emotional problems which plague our world. Even some of you think, Ajahn Brahm talks about nimittas and jhanas, I will never be able to do things like that. I say, of course you will be able to do that. It's possible for you. I've seen amazing people. People who, you know, who are have many more difficulties than you have. They can get these things, why not you? So by praising you, by opening up the possibilities, by saying it can be done and you can do it, that's all the praise you need to be able to stop all this negativity, I can't do this, and self-blaming. So you can do it, and that is an important part of your success in meditation. And after a while you can do it. Woohoo! Okay, the last question. These are the questions, oh my goodness, this always happens at this time. Is it true that metta energy is too compassionate to cleanse a house of negative spirits? I've heard that you will need a time medium who can get rid of the spirits once and for all. I've heard that you have had to bless the same house many times because the ghosts keep coming back. Is this true? No. Yeah, I think they love your compassionate energy. Don't get me wrong, I have faith in the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha and in metta. Thank you. No, to cleanse a house of negative spirits, sometimes you've got to check the spirit out. Because, oh, there's one house, I always remember this case, of going there, and it wasn't a Thai house, I think it was a Malaysian Chinese. And I went there, and they'd got, I think, a Christian priest to come and do an exorcism, and it didn't work. I said, of course, and then actually the ghost got worse. I said, of course, because you know that ghost, you know, doesn't want to be kicked out. It's quite happy here. So make peace with that ghost. So the loving kindness was not to get rid of the ghost, but to pacify it. So it was happy being there. And the house was big enough for the ghost and everybody. And if you get the ghost on side, the ghost will protect you and look after the house. And imagine that, you've got sort of like a spirit in the house who will look after it when you're away. So burglars won't have a chance of getting in. Fires, sometimes people experience that. A fire started in the house and someone woke them up. Ghosts can be very helpful if you treat them with respect. But of course there's other ghosts, and just, you know, they're in the wrong place at the wrong time, and those are the ones you just kindly, compassionately ask to leave. And of course they do leave. So a time medium can get rid of the spirits once and for all. Sometimes they can, sometimes they can't. You've had to bless the same house many times because the ghosts keep coming back. Now I think you're misunderstanding that story. That was the story from Dr. K. Sri Dharmananda, who there was a house close to his temple in Brickfields, Malaysia, which had a haunting, and they got many different religions to try and exorcise the ghost. Nothing worked, so he went there. He did the chanting and the ghost left. But the problem was the ghost just went next door. So the neighbours started to complain. So just pushing the ghost from one house to another wasn't that really what was required. So he had to do this chanting ceremony in all the houses of the street to make sure that the ghost left the neighbourhood and never even came back. Just pushing it, the problem, it was called kicking the can down the road. So was not really appropriate, so I had to get the ghost to go even further. So anyway, that's with some of the ghosts. And I can't finish off that story when you mention spirits without a ghost story. Are you afraid of ghosts? Now what's... I'll tell a simple ghost story. That was the ghost story of one of my friends who, she went on a tour of UK, went on holiday to England. And, you know, she never left Australia before. And so if you go to a place like UK, England, of course you'll go to visit the old castles, the old monuments. So she went to one of these castles, you know, many centuries old, and you know, she went on one of the tours of the dungeon areas. And in those dungeons, people used to do really mean and nasty and painful things to one another. So if you know, if you ever think there's any ghosts somewhere, you know, over there in the dungeons and of these old castles in England, there must be teeming with ghosts. But you know, she was okay. She didn't believe in ghosts and the supernatural. But nevertheless, when she started walking in that dungeon area, you know, the centuries-old floorboards would always creak. And that was spooky enough. And when they went past one of these high windows from the dungeons, the wind would always whistle. That's it. And even the doors, as they open and close. It was one of the spookiest tours she ever experienced in her life. And people say they don't believe in ghosts, but, you know, sometimes when you hear these sounds, sometimes maybe there is. But anyway, she was really relieved when the tour ended. And stupid lady, she had to ask. She had to ask the tour guide, in all the years you've lived in this, you've you know been in giving tours in this castle, have you ever seen or met a ghost? And the tour guide replied, in all the years I've lived in this castle, I've never seen a ghost. He said, how long have you lived here? And he said, over 300 years. Sadhu, sadhu. Okay, that's a good old joke. So I apologize for only doing a few questions tonight, but started getting into Nibbana and stuff. Thank you. So have a nice evening. We'll just leave these, well, there's a lot of questions here. Any more questions which you have, please put them in the box. We'll sort them out somehow or other.